This could get out of hand real easy, Mr. Richards. We don't want a riot on our hands.
A riot? Don't be ridiculous. High-spirited kids, that's what I see. They even gave themselves a name. They call themselves...
Ah, greetings from Jindal. This is your boy, Jody Havnot. You're listening to Strange Ways Podcast, and I'm excited to have a guest today. I'm here with Mr. Ken Barr. How you doing, Ken?
Doing awesome. How are you?
I'm pretty good, man. I'm feeling pretty good today. Finally, the rain let up, so we're getting a decent Skype thing going. I was kind of worried about it earlier, because man. You were telling me you had kind of storms today, too, right?
We had lightning strikes. I swear I could see them in the parking lot. They were that close. I was afraid we were going to lose internet tonight.
Yeah, that's a trip, man. You could see them that close, huh?
I could see lightning strikes about 150 feet away. I was seriously wondering what was going to happen. But it's all good now. It's all calmed down, so we are good to go.
Good to go tonight. So we're going to get into... I want to just mostly focus on Kiss, but you've done so much cool shit in your life, but... I want to take it all the way back to, like, how did you discover Kiss as a young man?
You know, I'm pretty sure it was on the Paul Lynn Halloween special. And I was probably about 12. And I think I was standing there in my pajamas, my jaw on the floor. Just, what am I seeing? It was just amazing.
Oh,
and
yeah.
After that, I know HBO in 77 had their Japanese concert on. And I watched that, and you know, once you're in, you're in. Once you're bitten by that bug. So from there, it was, back then we didn't have MTV or internet, but it was Hit Parade or Magazine was the big one. And you know, once you start seeing that, and just, I was hooked.
Hell so, yeah.
But yeah, definitely, I think Paul Lynn Halloween special, and it just blew me away. I'd never seen anything like it. You know, I've always been into music. I've actually got still the first single I ever bought. I saved my nickels and my pennies and bought the 45 of the Lovin' Spoonful Summer in the City, one of my all-time favorite songs.
Right.
And
on.
I still have it. I still have that 45. I've been into music since I've, you know, been old enough to walk around and go to the record store. So, but Kiss changed it, man. I mean, they just brought it to such a different level, and I'd never been knocked over before, and those guys, they bring it. They really do bring it.
Yes, they do, man. I love it. So, you grew up in the New York area, correct?
Yeah, Long Island, out in the eastern part. Very, very rustic where I grew up. Great place to be a kid. Just not a whole heck of a lot going on. But it's an awesome area.
So, I guess you were too young to see Kiss in the clubs in the New York scene, right?
Yeah, I was just a little bit too young, but my older sister saw them at the Academy gig, I think it was.
Really?
My one older sister... She was right at the prime, you know, going to see the New York Dolls and
nice.
That whole scene.
Yeah, I've always been enamored with that New York scene with Kiss and the Ramones and the Dolls and everybody, you know, Richard Hell.
Yeah. It was amazing. It was just what was coming out of that whole scene was just amazing. And there, the shame of it is, you know, for all the bands we have heard about, like the Ramones or the Dolls, there are 10 or 20 other incredible bands that just never made it.
Right.
And, you know, my sister would come home with pictures and just stories about these bands and the songs. And it was just such great exposure for me because you're limited, you know, 10 years old on Long Island, you're very limited. But she was going into Manhattan to Max's Kansas City, CBGB's, all the places.
Yeah.
And, you know, she knew the bands, and it was just amazing. So, yeah, I used to listen to her stories, and you know, it was, I wished I was a little older and could have gone out there. It would have, you know, I mean, I did get to see the Ramones as a kid. Actually, the day Tommy died last week, I sat up watching Rock and Roll High School, because I think when that came out, the local movie theater was one of those where it would play at 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock. And I went like 4 days in a row and watched it both times just because that the live sequence of them in concert just knocked me over.
Hell yeah, that's incredible. And, you know, I actually, everyone who knows me knows I'm a huge Ramones fan. I might be into them more than Kiss even, but they're kind of equal. But man, oh man, I couldn't believe the news about Tommy. It's like, all the guys are gone now, you know, besides Marky and CJ and Richie.
We lost all them way too young, way too soon.
I actually cried, dude. I'm man enough to say it, dude. I cried when I heard the news. Sucked.
There is nothing wrong with that, man. I mean, these people are a huge influence on our life. They're a part of our lives, whether they know it or not. You know, we invite them in and they become a part of who we are with their music and their life.
Exactly. Well said, brother. Well said. I want to know, what was your first Kiss record that you actually got?
Alive.
Alive.
Kiss Alive.
Hell yeah.
And actually, I didn't even buy it yet. But my local library used to stock vinyl, and they had the Kiss Alive record. So I think the day or two after the Paul Lynn special, I took my bicycle to the library and grabbed Kiss Alive and was home listening to it the rest of the day.
Hell yeah.
I mean, I love all music, but live records have always just got, they give you the energy, and especially those live Kiss records were the rawness, the power. You really kind of felt it and almost felt like you were there. So always a huge fan of the Alive records. And actually have a story, if it's okay to tell the same story on yours.
So I wanted to get into it. You're listed in the credits on Alive 3.
Yeah, and for me, that was huge, because I used to sit in my room listening to Alive 2 with a big gatefold record, reading the credits. I knew every crew guy's name on that thing, and I thought, man, it would be the coolest thing if these guys did another Alive record to be involved in it. And 15 years later, I was. And that's, you know, my Alive 3 gold is one of my most treasured possessions right now.
Hell yeah, man. I mean, you know, being that kid riding home on your bike with Alive, and then, you know, 15 years later, there you are. I mean, it's a strange and magical thing, and I think it's so fucking cool, dude. I really do.
Yes.
Yeah, truly something that can only happen in rock and roll. You know, rock and roll is one of those where dreams do come true.
Right. Let me ask you this. So, obviously, you worked with Kiss. Let's kind of trace the steps leading up to you working with Kiss. I mean, they weren't your first band you worked with, obviously.
No, I knocked around the bars from the time I was 15 till my early 20s. Back then, the Long Island club scene was such that you could actually play five nights a week, so you could make a decent living. But I had responsibilities, so I had a day job at a car lot, and then I would do gigs. And I'd go from like Wednesday till Sunday with no sleep. But the bands were great on Long Island back then, and the opportunities were there. I learned a lot. I networked a lot, and that's what comes in handy. You know, it's the people you meet on the way up. Hopefully everybody continues to go up and in the industry, and those are the people you rely on later on. But as for me, I've been knocking around the clubs forever as a guitar tech, heavy metal bands. You know, a lot of opportunities came really, really close, and then, you know, it all comes crashing down on you and you're starting over again.
Right.
And I'd gotten to a point where I was about done. I just thought, you know, I'm working my ass off and making no money, and I'm going nowhere. So what's funny was I had the day job at a car lot, and the guy who was a welder across the street was the same as me. He was another guy looking for a break. And he'd been working for a pop singer on the weekends, and he had just actually gotten offered a drum tech gig with White Lion, and a real tour, you know?
Right.
So he was, you know, going to be getting on a tour bus, and off he went. And, you know, that was enormous for him. Well, he asked me to take over his weekend gig with the pop singer, whose name was Debbie Gibson. We were doing weekends because she was still in high school, and she had two singles on the charts.
Right.
Which was impressive.
Yeah, and she wrote them. I mean, little side note, she was talented.
Yes.
Wrote, produced, she holds the record for the youngest person to write, produce, and record a number one hit, which was Foolish Beat in 1988.
Yeah.
Wonderful people, too. But that turned out to be my first tour, which was a substantially larger tour. We played outdoor amphitheaters. And that led to Air Supply, which led to the Bangles tour I did in 89.
Oh, man, and the Bangles, huh? That's awesome.
Yeah, the sound guy on the Debbie Gibson tour, Steve, my friend Steve, was married to the drummer, and he was their sound man slash production manager. So we got along. He liked how I worked. He brought me over to that. And that's how it works.
Right.
You know, it's not resumes. It's who's seen your work, who respects your work.
Right. It's all who you know.
Yeah. And another thing to consider, you know, anyone considering getting into that, it's not just being good at your job. You've got to be easy to live with, because you've got 10 guys on a bus, and if somebody's an asshole, he's just not going to last.
Oh, you know, that's right. That actually broke up one of my bands. You know, we went on our first pretty big tour, came home, done.
Yeah.
It can crush people, you know.
The smallest things can become major battles after a while. It gets hard out there. So if you've got people that can work and get along and play nice, they're gold. So anyway, after another Debbie Gibson tour, someone I'd worked the clubs with, Al Petrelli, and he'd gotten the Alice Cooper gig for the Trash Tour, who was their lead guitar player slash musical director.
Right.
And he asked me to come out with him, so I did. And it was awesome. I was always an Alice Cooper fan, still am.
Hell yeah.
And Al and I had worked the bars together forever, and this was his big break. And it was a significant step up for me. And after two legs of Alice, our drummer, Alice's drummer, Jonathan Mover, decided that he was going to go back to playing with Joe Satriani. And we were going to, in L.A., in between legs of the tour, have rehearsals. Three people were brought in. Each one knew somebody in the band. One, I cannot remember to save my life. I think his name was Charlie. The other was Jimmy DeGrasso, and the third was Eric Singer.
Wow.
Eric crossed paths when I was out with Debbie Gibson, and he was in Badlands. I knew his old drum tech, so we went to each other's shows. We had a day off in the same town. And that was my introduction to Eric. So fast forward later in the year, he's auditioning for Alice Cooper, and I helped him set up his drums. You know, I was the only tech there. They just had me because I could do anything.
Right.
And it wasn't hard to see Alice really liked it. Everybody that auditioned brought it, but Eric just had what Alice was looking for, and Eric got the gig.
Hell yeah.
So I did two tours with Eric. I was guitar teching Al Petrelli and Derek Sherinian's keyboards. And the 91 tour, it was a guy named Steph Burns on guitar. And Eric and I had always gotten along. He knew I could do drums. There were times I helped his drum tech. And then in 91, he had played on the Kiss Revenge record and was going to be uncredited. And unfortunately, we lost Eric Carr, and that changed everything. And we were out in Europe, and Eric and I went out to dinner one night, and after a little while, he eventually came around to telling me that not only had he been offered the gig and he was taking it, he offered me the gig as his tech. He wanted me to come in with him. He wanted his guy, not someone who previously held the position that may or may not work out.
Right.
And that was my foot in the door that led to my career with Kiss.
That's awesome, man. So what did being such a Kiss fan, was it like mind-blowing to just be there working with Kiss, you know? Because for me, I'd probably freak out a little bit.
You know, it was. Part of me was the seasoned old road dog who had a job to do, who had to prove himself, because every situation you're hired into, you've got to prove yourself all over again. You know, these people didn't know me the way Eric did.
Right.
So you're part that, but then there's part of you. Yeah, I am still that, you know, kid on his bicycle with Alive, you know, ride to read it, to listen to it rather. And you know, you wrestle with both parts of that. You know, I'm a fan, and there were times I got to talk to Gene about comic books and you know, all the things that we were both into, and you know, those are amazing times that you never think are going to happen. And it was a great time, but like I said, you know, you have to balance being at the top of your game, because you not only just having the gig doesn't mean you're going to keep it. You're only as good as your last show.
Right.
So you know, part of me was still a big fan and very, very thankful for the job, but you know, on the other hand, I mean, I've got to be a grown up and get the job done and not be, you know, staring to wait for Gene to breathe fire, even though, you know, I kind of did a few times. That never gets old. I'm sorry.
It just never. Let me ask you this, man, since, okay, so you come in at Revenge and you already knew Eric, but let me just get a couple, you know, impressions from each guy. I mean, let's hear how your meeting with Gene went your first time, you know, and then Paul and then Bruce.
It was at a rehearsal. It was a small rehearsal place where they'd already been. They were already set up. I was brought in, and Bruce just came up to me, shook my hand, said hello, and that, you know, that was okay. Right. Paul Stanley walked right up to me, shook his hand, said, "Hi, I'm Paul. Nice to meet you." Mm-hmm. And then I walked over to, you know, Gene was sitting on the couch at the rehearsal place, and Eric introduced me to him and said, "This is Kenny Barr. He's going to be doing my drums." Right. And Gene just looked me, you know, straight in the face and just said, "Why?" And I had nothing. I stood there for a minute and I just, nothing. So I just wandered over to the drums and started working. I still to this day don't have a good reply for that. So.
Right. I would just have been like, because Eric asked me to, man, you know?
But it, you know, they started rehearsing and being on that drum riser, listening to those songs in that room with them. Of course, it was amazing. It's the fan's dream come true. And it was also a gig as a professional I felt thankful for having, because it's a band I've always believed in, and it was where I wanted to be, and it's where I was.
Right.
You know, I could not have been more thankful, and I've always been thankful for my time with the band.
Hell yeah, that's so cool. I'm a bit of a tech head, and a lot of our listeners are too, so can you just kind of give us what was, like, you know, what was Paul running, just like a Marshall half stack or what? Just in rehearsals.
Oh, in rehearsals, yeah, it was all small Marshall, I believe.
Yeah. Gene just had an Ampeg.
It was nothing big and nothing crazy loud, because it wasn't needed. The room was small.
Right.
I was so focused on Eric and that part of it, I'm just kind of not.
I feel you.
Remember.
I'm just such a tech head, you know. I was curious as to whether they were running straight into their amps or they were running pedal board, you know, shit like that. I'm a bit of a gearhead.
Those guys have never really been big on pedal boards. I know a lot of the stuff, like Bruce has the auto wah built into his guitar, because I think that stems from back in the earlier days when they all had the big boots on. You couldn't really run a pedal board, so
right.
I assume they did without them. It's not like nowadays where you got a crew guy running it off stage for you.
Right. Plus, they didn't have a whole lot of effects anyway. You know, pretty straightforward guitar rig.
I mean, Gene's got the Space Echo for the intro of God of Thunder.
Yeah.
And Bruce, I know, had the auto wah on his guitar, which was pretty cool. That was the first time I'd ever seen that. It's just, you know, like a separate volume pod, except it has the wah effect, and he could do it right there without being confined to a pedal board.
Yeah, that's kind of trippy. I've never heard of anyone doing that before. It's cool.
Yeah, yeah. And other than that, like I said, I, honest to God, just don't really remember a lot of it. Used in the rehearsal. It was just such a hectic time for me, you know. I was working with Eric. I was doing the microphone, you know, swinging the microphone in and out for choruses when he'd sing, making sure his drums were perfect. It's a handful.
Yes. And
it was great, but it definitely kept me busy and just focused on him.
Right. You were there, you know, when Eric was first coming into the band. Did it seem like people accepted him right away? Because, you know, I accepted him right away, but did you have any people, like, kind of slagging the guy live or anything right at the beginning?
The only thing I ever heard back then, and it sounds ridiculous now, is a lot of the fans complained that he didn't have to dye his hair black.
Yeah, that was kind of a thing back then. People were like, "Oh my God, there's a dude with blonde hair in the band."
But as far as his playing, I don't think that ever was called into question, because the guy, you know, he brought the goods. He's a great drummer.
He's a beast, brother.
Yes.
And he's a good fit for that band. He's high energy, and he just, you know, he drives that car. I think he's the engine on the car driving, and he keeps them at 100 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And plus, like, when he first came back, they started bringing back some of the heavier Kiss shit. Do you think, was it partly due because of Eric's a heavier drummer than Eric Carr was? You know, like, they all of a sudden they're doing, you know, Watching You and Parasite comes back and stuff.
I think that... I know there have always been songs Eric's wanted to play.
Right. And yeah, because he was a Kiss fan.
Yeah. And there are songs that, you know, the way he approaches them are pretty, it's pretty impressive, and I think he just enjoys it. As to why, I couldn't really say. I can only speculate, and I think that it's just the relationship musically with Eric, he just brought the goods, and they were able to do songs in a way that they hadn't been able to do them previously.
Hell
and
yeah.
Like I said, I know there are songs Eric likes, and you know he'll keep asking and he'll keep asking. So you know, if they can do it, why not?
There you go. Yeah, man, that's cool that, you know, Eric's kind of pushing for some of the ones that a lot of us fans really like too, the kind of the heavier ones, you know?
Oh, yeah, and I believe he pushed to do Black Diamond, which he impresses me because when I first met him, I didn't know he could sing. I didn't know he could sing till the first day of rehearsal with Kiss.
Right.
I mean, he never gave any indication, you know, on Alice Cooper that that was what he did, and when he did it, and then when he started singing lead-on songs, I was really impressed.
Yeah, he's got a great voice, man. I think it's kind of a prerequisite if you're going to be in Kiss. You got to be able to sing Black Diamond if you're the drummer. I mean, they always play it.
Yeah, and that's a great song. It's always been one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah, classic.
And his song on the new record is amazing. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I like his vocals a lot, man. Anything you see of him, you know, he's been singing a lot more in the recent years. And him and Gene together sound fantastic.
Yes.
Yep. Absolutely.
I think. So,
they're good together.
Okay, yeah. So, let's kind of go chronologically. So, you guys do the Revenge Tour, and, you know, it was kind of hit or miss in some cities, you know, it started with the club tour. We weren't lucky enough here in St. Louis for them to play at the club tour, unfortunately. But, so, I mean, you guys kind of, you know, the plug was kind of pulled on the Revenge Tour, correct?
I don't know. I just know that we were booked until December, whatever. And when I left and went home, it was my understanding we were going to work again. We just didn't know when or where.
Right.
And then, nothing materialized. So yeah, I really never kind of got bogged down in the decision making process and you know who's doing what and why and
right.
Was the plug pulled or did other projects come up. You know, that kind of stuff wasn't really in the purview of what I did, so I kind of, you know, I honest to God just don't know.
Right. So you guys roll into the convention tour, right? I mean, that was the next step.
Actually, they did a bunch of work in 93 and 94 that I was out with Stone Temple Pilots, and I know they did South America in 94, and they did a few other things that I was not able to be part of.
Right. It was like the Kiss My Ass was kind of the in-between moments, right?
In there somewhere, yeah. That came out, I'm not really even sure, maybe right around the convention time. I'm not real clear. But in January of 95, we did Australia and Japan, which were awesome. I love both those places. And I think it was the first time Kiss had been to Australia in 15 years, so that was just mayhem there.
Oh, yeah.
And that was actually when they started doing their conventions. They did them in Australia on days off. And very, very well received over there. So I think that was the genesis of their convention tour, which, you know, resumed in the summer of 95 here in the States.
Yeah, I went. It was awesome.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you got to see a lot of cool memorabilia, all the costumes.
Even that Peter's drum kit.
Oh, yeah. I used to set that one up, the mirror kit.
Yeah.
And, awesome. And, you know, we had the tribute bands, which were always fun. You know, whatever we could do to keep it busy. And then the band would play and then do autographs. It was a full day for the fans, I think.
Yeah, it was great. Fun. It seemed to me at the time it was like $100 and it seemed unheard of. It's like flash forward to today and that's nothing, you know what I mean?
Yes.
I'd pay that every day of the week if they would do it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And for what you got then, you got, you know, a bird's eye view of lyrics to Doctor, I think one of them was lyrics to Doctor Love that Gene had handwritten.
Yeah, the original Love Gun painting, all the costumes.
And those guys were right up close and personal after the acoustic set. I mean, they were given as many autographs. They autographed anything you wanted.
Right. You didn't even have to pay for it extra either.
No, it was included. So the $100, I think, you know, and people, I think they, didn't they do like a laminate or a ticket, a fun ticket or something, a souvenir?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it was a brilliant move on their part. I don't think that at that point in time they really could have played a traditional tour, it wouldn't have done that well. And what they managed to do was put together something that was one of the biggest money makers of that season.
Oh, and yeah, I know, man, they're making money hand over fist, dude.
Yeah, and it's just nothing but smart, you know? They bought their own lights and sound. We were all self-contained. We had our crew. We'd roll in, do these things. You know, every one of them, I believe, was sold out. So you know what you've got. You can budget. And the merchandise was unheard of what they sold. I mean, the stuff flew off the shelves. Our t-shirt guy was just dumbfounded.
Right.
So, and that didn't come popping out of the air. That was, you know, some smart people putting together a business plan, executing it.
Right.
So you really have to give the respect for that, because, you know, a lot of bands can say, I could have done that, but they're not doing it. You know, these guys did it. You know, they broke ground again in a whole different area and were successful at it.
Yeah, they were. And it more or less led us into the whole reunion, because that led to Unplugged, right? Because they were already totally comfortable by the time MTV asked them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were there for Unplugged too, right?
Unplugged, I teched for Gene, Eric, and Peter. So, okay. I was busy.
This is a story I gotta hear, man. So, you know, had you ever met Ace or Peter up to that point?
No.
Okay,
no.
So you're already working for Kiss, and then all of a sudden they're like, hey, we're gonna get together. I guess you were there when Peter stepped up in LA and did Hard Luck Woman, right?
Yep, and it was great. You could feel the magic starting to return. There's something there. There really is.
So they were probably thinking after that, wow, what would happen if we had Ace and Peter on MTV, you know? So what did you think when they told you, you know, we're going to have to get together with Peter and Ace and work up a couple songs? Were you like, holy shit?
I was excited, because after my dream of being on the Live 3, my next bucket list was, if Kiss ever get back together, I want to be there.
Hell yeah.
And I was, you know, there's bucket item number two. Those guys at the rehearsal studio playing all the old songs, the four of them for the first time in however many years. You know, I was privileged and honored to be there. It'd be, you know, it's another Kiss fan's dream come true to be there that day. And it was amazing. And I'll use the word magic relating to them quite a bit, because there certainly is. It's a chemistry. It's an intangible. But there's something there, and when the four of them did it, it's amazing. I mean, no disrespect to anyone else that's ever been in the band, because they've all earned their spot.
Definitely.
But the four original guys, the reunion tour, that, you know, that speaks to it right there, the success of that. I mean, it was what the world wanted, and, you know, continue to want, is Kiss.
Right. They definitely delivered.
They absolutely did.
So you were in the room. I mean, did it seem like, what was it like? You know, how were they interacting with each other, the four original guys? Were they seeming like they were... We've all seen some of the footage, but you were actually there. So what was it actually like, man? I just got to know.
I think that, the first couple of minutes is kind of everybody getting situated. And after that, it was like four old friends, four brothers, just picking up where they left off. And it was smooth. It was fun. They were kidding and laughing and it was a great way to see them, because you didn't know what was going to happen. And it was great. It was family. It was like a family reunion, family getting back together again.
That's so cool, man.
The thing for me, though, is I was kind of busy. On the convention tour, Gene didn't play an acoustic bass. He played an electric through a small amp.
Right.
And for the MTV shoot, they said, no, everyone has to have an acoustic guitar. It's what we do.
Right.
So I had to find Gene an acoustic bass that still gave him the monster, you know, the tone and the sound he wanted.
Yeah.
And he wanted to do that on the road. And I just told him, Gene, those acoustics through your amp are just going to feed back and sound horrible. Let's just get a stack of 10 basses at SIR. We'll go through them, take you an hour, we'll find you a bass. And he asked if I could get that done. I said yes. And he just said, all right, done. And that's what we did.
There you go.
So
I ended up going with the Kramer, right?
Yeah, we had these high-end basses that were wonderful, multi-thousand-dollar handmade instruments. They were wonderful, but they were not the monster. And that Kramer bass, as soon as you picked it up, that was. I knew it as soon as I heard it. I handed it to him. He had a look on his face, and yeah, that's it. So yeah. I just rounded him up a spare so we'd have two, and we were good. But besides that, I was teching for Peter Chris, who I'd never worked with before, and I still had to take care of Eric. So as much as I was enjoying being there, at times it did get a little overwhelming just trying to make sure everybody was okay. And ultimately, they were fine and couldn't have been easier to work for. But
right.
I was trying to mentally be ready, because this was going to be a perfect night, this show.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, you know, I would run through my head what can break and what's the quickest way to fix it, you know, because I didn't want to be the one responsible for this perfect night to not be perfect.
Yeah, so, that's a lot of pressure. You have two drum sets to tech and a bass rig.
Yeah. And not just, you know, not just the instruments. These are not just rock stars. This is the reunion. This is the special night that has to be perfect.
Yeah, that was like the big magical phoenix rises from the ashes, man.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I put a lot of pressure on myself, and I probably could have enjoyed it a lot more. But, you know, a couple days later, in retrospect, you decompress, you kind of process it all. And that's when, you know, I sat home, had a beer on the back patio, and just kind of smiled and said, yeah, we did do that, didn't we?
Hell yeah. Did you, you know, even when you were there, did you feel the magic? Did you smell a reunion coming? What's up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The magic was there. The magic was there in rehearsals. The magic was there at that night. There was something. As far as reunion, I'd heard them say no so many times, I kind of...
Yeah.
I knew something had to happen because there was something there, and I think that it was something that the world wanted, and we all knew that, but I think that the enormity of it when it actually happened a year later, I don't even think the KISS guys were really ready for how well it would sell. You know, the multiple nights in arenas, Tiger Stadium selling out in, you know, 10 minutes or whatever the heck it was.
Yeah,
I think it didn't even occur, you know, it hadn't hit everybody how big a deal this was until that thing got rolling. And then it was just, hold on, you know, let's just see where this takes us.
Hell yeah, it was totally awesome. They played St. Louis, like, I think it was the third show on the reunion tour, if you don't count the Weenie Roast. But amazing, man, fucking amazing. That's all I could say. I still think about it like once a week.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh,
absolutely.
Man. Because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't old enough to see KISS in makeup, you know. So I was one of those people that, you know, I would have been, you know, 4 or 5, I guess, when they were still in makeup, you know. So I didn't get to go. So it was amazing for me to, you know, to actually see the original dudes and just fucking out of control awesome. So you were actually there at the Weenie Roast, right? The actual first, you know, basically the first gig they played in makeup together since, you know, 79 or whatever it was.
Yeah, I was for that, because Peter had a guy. There really, initially there was talk of me being Gene's bass tech, but they decided to just go with someone in LA.
Right.
And I was still considered part of the family, so they brought me out as a set carpenter, which it's not really my strength, but you go out, you bust ass, you do what you can for the family, and it was a lot of work, and it wasn't hard to see that it just wasn't a good fit for either of us. So after the Weenie Roast, a couple days later, I left. They already had someone in mind they wanted. You know, no hard feelings, all good. This just isn't, you know, not everybody's good at everything. And I just was not that level of a set carpenter, and they really needed somebody with better skills. So I left. When Alice Cooper just happened to be going out, and I slid right into a guitar tech slot, which is where I was stronger.
Right.
KISS got a better carpenter, and they went out and they did their tour, and it was awesome.
Oh, yeah. But what was it like? I mean, you were present at the Weenie Roast, right?
Oh, I was working the Weenie Roast, yeah.
You got to see, I mean, what kind of magic was there that day being there? I mean, were people going absolutely apeshit? Because the video, you know, there's a lot of problems. They're kind of sloppy, and that's to be expected. But what was it like to actually be there? Was it fucking totally amazing or what?
Well, I have to preface this story with we were rehearsing in an aircraft hangar, and the loadout of that, we worked all day, loaded out all night, straight into the Irvine Meadows for the Weenie Roast, and went right to loading in. And by the time it was showtime, I think we'd all been up about 3.5 days straight, nonstop work. So the level of exhaustion, I think, was the pervading thing at that time, as magical as it was going to be. It was hot. You know, I was up on the roofs of the lavatory buildings with the inflatables trying to get those things to happen. And funny thing, you know, the audience is already in, you know, we're still working.
Right.
You know, you plug one, we're pulling power from wherever to get these inflatables up.
Right.
You know, you pull power, you get, oh, there goes the Peter Criss one, the crowd goes wild. You know, Paul Stanley, Ace Frehley, they blow up, crowd goes wild. I plugged in that fucking Gene Simmons inflatable, it blew the breaker and all four of them came down. There's 10,000 people booing the guys on the roof of the bathroom.
Oh, man. Murphy's Law, right?
Yeah. It was good to be there. You know, one of my cool gigs, I used to raise the hydraulic walls of amps, which was cool.
Oh, right on.
And when Gene was doing God of Thunder, when he was leaning out over the edge of the stage and, you know, drooling blood and smoke is coming up, I was actually in the pit with the smoke machine, making sure it was where it needed to be and trying to dodge blood as he was drooling. But, you know, to be 5 feet from Gene as he's doing the blood routine, getting into God of Thunder, is incredible.
Yeah, it is. I'm envious, brother. I really am. That's fucking cool, man. That's just flat out fucking cool.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, you know, like you said, man, the kid on the bike, you know, riding home with Alive, you know, years later, you know, doing the fucking smoke for Gene to fucking drool blood. I mean, this is just too cool, man. It's too cool.
Yeah, it's nice, you know, when your life goes full circle and you land exactly where you want to be.
Hell yeah. I mean,
that, you know, what are the odds? It's what I still to this day ask myself sometimes, what are the odds? You know, I look back on it now and, you know, I still know all those people and, you know, the memories are there. And some days I think to myself, did that really happen? Because that's really way too cool to happen to anyone.
Right. It's like, am I dreaming? Somebody pinch me, man.
Yeah, you really do kind of get that to a degree because, you know, I was about 28, I think. All my dreams have come true. Here I am. It's like, where do you go from that when everything on your bucket list is done?
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow, I need a bigger bucket.
What you do is you start writing books, right?
Books and start making movies and all sorts of things, yeah.
Yes, sir. We need to get into your book a little bit here. For all you people out there, Ken's an author. He makes movies as well. I think most people know that already, but... You got the book We Are the Road Crew, mentions a lot of KISS stuff, correct?
Yeah, it's my career from the first bar gigs on Long Island up until my last tour, which was in 2000 with Alice Cooper. And, you know, one of the things that, it's funny, you look on Amazon, and I've had good reviews and bad reviews for the same thing, that I don't chuck any dirt about the bands. So it just goes to show you can't please anybody because people are praising me and damning me for the exact same thing.
Right.
It's that book is my tribute to the career I loved. There's nothing bad in it. It's just a loving memory of a tour and many tours and a career where I was privileged to work with a lot of good people. And it's, you know, I don't regret a day of it. There's not a day I would change.
Oh, yeah. That's a great subject, you know. Any rock and roller is going to appreciate road stories, whether you've been there or you just want to know what it's like, you're going to appreciate it. So I think everyone needs to check that shit out, man.
Yes.
Where can they find it?
Amazon is your best bet, and it's also available on Kindle. And if you want the, you can go to iTunes for the audiobook. I partnered with a voiceover artist, and we put that out last year.
Oh, right on.
And you can just go to my Ken Barr page on Amazon because I've got about 9 other books on there.
Yeah, I saw that. It's awesome.
Yeah, I keep busy. I try to keep busy.
So
it's like chapter 2 of my life. Hopefully either the books or the movies will eventually bring me up to another level where I want to be.
Yeah, because We Are the Road Crews of Volume 1, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it was always my intent on doing one book devoted exclusively to my time with KISS with a lot more detail and pictures.
There you go.
I'd like to do a book on Alice Cooper. And I've got a lot of notes, and those are still on the back burner. I think when the time is right, I'll get back into those. I've gone in a few different directions with books and stuff, and it has to feel right. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of bullshit. You know, when I wrote We Are the Road Crew, it was a labor of love. It was a true labor of love because it was a career I truly loved, and it was my tribute to that. So when the time is right, I'll probably, you know, I've got all my old itineraries. I've got tons of photographs. You'll put something together, but, you know, it has to be something I want to be proud of, not something I knock off to make a couple bucks.
Right. Let me ask you this, because we haven't really touched on my guy, and I'm a huge Ace guy. And so since you were there when they were rehearsing and shit, you got any Ace stories for our listeners?
Not really.
Really?
We just didn't interact. He had a tech that he brought with him, a guy named Dean that had been working with him. And I just didn't. He kind of showed up, plugged in, and played. So,
right.
I've got one of the earlier copies of Kistory that he signed, though, because he'd never seen one before. And so I think when he signed mine, that might have been the first one he signed, which for me is a big deal.
Hell yeah, that Kistory book is awesome, bro.
Yeah, it is. It's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah.
But no real Ace stories. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay, man. I just had to ask. I'd be remiss if I didn't, yeah. You know.
Like I said, you know, Eric and Peter and Gene, that was kind of a lot. That was, you know, three eggs in one basket, and I was trying to make sure that they were all spot on, happy, and dialed in, and all that good stuff.
Right. Was there any, like, a time on tour or anything where Eric had any major malfunctions, like, you know, a broken snare head or anything like that?
He's had a few, you know, blowing out a bottom snare head, but that goes back to, I would always run through my head what's the quickest way to fix any particular thing, so we were always pretty quick, and we were in sync a lot, so this is in the book, it's not really a malfunction, I guess, but it was it's a funny story.
Yeah, what you got?
We're in Indianapolis, wherever there was racing, and he had gotten with some of the other guys, and they got a tour of the racing facility, and they gave him a bunch of, you know, swag. They gave him fireproof shoes like the drivers wear, and all of a sudden, and he came back to the gig all happy with this. He's like, oh, it's fireproof stuff. It's, well, you know, I'm in KISS. I should be wearing fireproof. Well, up until this point, Eric had always worn these karate shoes, and that's what he always played in. Well, he got these fireproof driver shoes, and, you know, he wanted to play in them, so he did. So we go up there to start the show, and after one or two songs, he looks at me and goes, my right kick pedal is there something wrong? So I reach over, I swap it out quick. A couple songs later, he's like, this left pedal's not right either. And, you know, swap it out, and he keeps looking, like, it's not right. And finally, I looked at him, and he looked at me. It's those fucking shoes. They're new, they're stiff, they're fireproof. So I had to leave the stage, which I'd never done before, run to the dressing room, grab his karate shoes, and you can't just take a break and, you know, ask everyone to go get a t-shirt while you change out your guy's shoes. So he continued to play. I went over, I changed out his right shoe for him, and then, you know, he's playing like double kick with his one foot while I'm changing out the shoe on his foot.
Oh, so he's playing his bass drum with his left foot then.
He's playing, and he did not miss a beat. And then I go over and I change the other shoe out. It's like, you know, it's like the Indy pit crew there. Just, okay, let's rotate the tires on this one.
Right.
But I mean, as far as malfunctions, little things breaking, you know, cymbals here and there, nothing tragic.
Right.
And everything was usually repaired pretty quickly. You know, Eric's got good gear. He's a precision player. He doesn't beat on the stuff. So it was usually pretty smooth sailing. We might have had to, you know, some nights maybe a little trouble dialing his monitors in just right, but I had a phone that went right over to the monitor desk, so that wasn't too bad either.
Right.
It's just, you know, we'd worked together long enough. I knew how he wanted the things, and he had told me when we first started working together, he said, you know, I look at my drum kit as like my car. You know, once you get the seat and the side view mirror and the rear view mirror all exactly how you want them, that's how it, you know, needs to be.
Right.
And once you have that, you know, you're in, you're golden.
That's what's up.
Yeah, I mean, nothing, like I said, nothing bad, nothing tragic, but if we had had any, there's no breakage that I could not have had repaired in half a song, because I just obsessively, compulsively always wanted the show to be perfect and would always in my head figure out what's the quickest way to go and do X, Y, and Z.
There you go.
And Eric was great. He'd play around me no matter what I was fixing or how much I was in his way. He'd play around me and keep it going.
Hell yeah, that's awesome. What did you think when, you know, this is after you had stopped working with him, I guess, but what did you think when Eric came back wearing Peter's makeup?
Eric actually called me and asked me to come back. I think that was that for the Olympics in Japan, I think?
I think so.
Eric actually called me and said, do you want to come back? And as much as I did, I had made other commitments in my life that prohibited that, and it broke my heart to not go back.
Right.
As far as that, I know a lot of people say a lot of things. Kiss needed a drummer, and I don't know the reasons and the whys why Peter wasn't in the band, but for whatever reason, Peter wasn't in the band. So Eric Singer made perfect sense, and I think he continues to make perfect sense, you know?
I do too, bro. I mean, who else are they going to get?
Yeah, well, we'd all love to see the original four, and they've all got their stuff, and, you know, why they can't do it is between them. So I think right now we're getting the best that we can get. You know, Tommy and Eric, they bring it every night. They're reliable. They're great players. You know, we're seeing, I think we're seeing, we're getting a great product.
I do too. And, you know, I'd rather have two extra guys that aren't Ace and Peter than no Kiss at all, you know?
Absolutely. And like I said, they're still bringing it, you know? There's not that magic that we had with the original four, but we're still getting something memorable, something we'll carry with us forever, you know, and something we'll go see again and again.
You got that right. I mean, I've never went to a Kiss show and not had a blast, you know? I mean, it's just fun. And anytime they're anywhere near me, I'm there. You know, it doesn't matter.
This new truss they have with all the moving stuff, the big spider or whatever they're calling it, is awesome.
Hell yeah, it's fucking... I haven't got to see that yet live, but I'm seeing it here in August, so I'm excited.
I won't even tell you about it because it does so many different cool things.
Well, I've seen a lot of video and shit, but I haven't been there yet. You know what I mean?
It's really well designed. It's well done. It's well thought out. It really looks cool. And it gives them all different spotlights and...
Yeah,
they're really for that stage, they've really got a lot going on, and it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I like when it comes down, and then the legs are like, you know, lighting up different areas and different colors and everything. It's awesome.
Oh yeah,
it's totally awesome.
The whole thing is it's impressive.
Yeah. So when you were teching for Gene, this is another gearhead question, but he was just pretty much running the SVTs or what? Because he has such that he gets so much overdrive. Is he just overdriving his rig, or does he use, you know, a little bit?
When I teched for him, it was the unplugged where he was just in a small little.
Oh yeah, that's right. Well, what about the weenie roast? You weren't teching for him, I guess.
No, I wasn't teching for him. I know he had a couple of SVTs under the stage that were loud as shit, and then whatever, it kept the stage volume down. So I know there were like two or three SVTs down underneath. And I'm sure they were mic'd, and he had a direct box.
Right.
Like I said, you know, on 10 or probably 11, you know, in the monster.
Yeah.
But I'd just be at that point guessing, because I just never really got involved with their gear because Eric just, you know, kept me busy.
I gotcha. Yeah, it's cool though, still, man, that you were there. I just think that's cool.
Oh, absolutely. I'm still as tired as I was. I think by the time we did the show and loaded out, we'd all been up, the crew wise. Have been up for 5 days straight in the heat, and I think I literally slept for a day and a half after. But you know, when I got up, it was a good feeling that I had done it. At this point, I knew that it was time for me to go, and I was starting to make the arrangements. But it was still a good feeling to have been there and done it.
Hell yeah, kicking off a whole new era, you know.
Yes,
absolutely. Did you still go?
Excuse me, sorry.
No, I was just saying that it's still going. I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
I was just had a few more questions for you, if that's cool.
Sure. No, that's fine.
We haven't really touched on... Did you have a favorite... You know, who was your favorite member growing up? Was it Gene, Ace, Paul, what?
You know, I was always a wannabe guitar player, so I was always an Ace guy. But when I saw them at Madison Square Garden in 79, you know, this is no MTV, no internet. You really... except for Hit Parade or Magazine, you really didn't know much about it.
Right.
And I'm at Madison Square Garden, and they come rising up out of the floor, which knocked me out. And then later on in the show, I see Gene flying up into the rig. And I was like Beavis and Butthead. I was just dumbfounded. And it's hard for Gene to not be your favorite between Breathing Fire and...
Flying.
Oh, it's all badass. I mean, he's like a superhero up there more than the rest. Yeah. So I think I always kind of went back and forth between Ace and Gene. But Ace just had this cool vibe. And Madison Square Garden in the late 70s had different posters on different sides of the building. And for years, there was one of Ace with his smoker guitar And it was just like, man, it doesn't get better than that. You know, you're from New York City, and there you are, bigger than life on Madison Square Garden.
Hell yeah, that's fucking awesome. So, do you have a favorite Kiss record?
Alive 3.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess you'd probably have to go with Alive 3, bro.
To be honest, the first three Alives, because the first one's got such a garagey, kind of rough, rawness to it. The second one was the full concert experience, except for the one side.
Yeah.
And it had, you know, a bit more clarity to it. And then the third one was the culmination of my career with them. So I just stack all three of them together because I'm going to listen to them one after the other anyway.
Hell yeah. You can't go wrong with the Alives.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely not.
What did you think?
What's your favorite Kiss record?
I love Dress to Kill, man. It was my first one, and so I'm just stuck on it, bro. I love it.
Yeah, it's nothing like your first one. I know that.
Right. But I love the Alives as well. You know, I mean, Kiss is a live entity.
I would like to say I am a huge Revenge fan, because that record, that's when I came in. It's a record I still love. Unholy and Take It Off and Domino. It was a badass record.
Right. And Gene was kind of back to form, a little more on the demon side again, you know.
Absolutely. Unholy Alone, I love that song. It's just such a heavy, great song.
Yeah, that's definitely the standout track of the record in my mind.
Yeah.
Revenge for me, though, I think at the time I really loved it, you know. I was a teenager. It was awesome. But it doesn't really hold up for me, bro. I just, it's not one of those ones I pull out all the time. And, you know, a lot of people can't imagine that someone doesn't love Revenge as much as they do, but I'm that guy.
You know, not everything for everybody. It takes a lot of different things to you know, get things going.
Right, like different strengths.
You know, yeah, exactly. I mean, there's some mid-80s records of theirs that, you know, not so much. I know people that love them.
Right.
It's just, you know, but there's enough of us that believe in it and that love it that every one of them sells. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, it's all good.
That's something that we haven't really touched on either. You know, being a fan from the original days, what did you think when they took the makeup off?
I was excited to see it. You know, at that point, I think if the original four had taken their makeup off, it would have been a much bigger deal. But by then it was Eric Carr and Vinnie Vincent, so...
Especially Vinnie, who'd only been in the makeup for like half a second, you know?
And honestly, his makeup wasn't that great. It's just
this goofy looking dude.
Yeah, an Egyptian Ankh. What are you, the Pharaoh or something?
Right.
So, I was just excited that they were still working, and you know, at that time, that the Lick It Up record was good, and MTV was playing the hell out of All Hell's Breaking Loose. It was exciting, you know. To me, it was, because they were back out there. It was a lot of energy, you know. They were competing with the other bands on their terms.
Yeah, they were.
And they were kicking ass.
Hell yeah, they were. I love Lick It Up and Animal. I'm a big fan of the non-makeup Kiss, because when I was a kid, that's how they were, you know. So I mean, I grew up with Kiss like that, you know. They were already out of makeup, so I mean,
thing about them is they transcend all genres, because they've been through it, you know. They've lived it, they've done it. So there's a genre for everybody, you know, the non-makeup Kiss, the early days, the original band, what we have now, you know, the Kiss Symphony record. There's really such a plethora of work out there. There's something that everyone's going to fall in love with, like it's their first.
Right. Yeah, it's like there's not a whole lot of bands that have such a wealth of material that you can find just about any, you know, mood you're looking for. You can find it on a Kiss record.
Yep. You know, there's... 40 years there, that's a lot to draw from. And
oh, yeah.
One thing I'll mention, it's a record a lot of us don't really talk about, is The Elder.
Love
and
it.
For all it's good and it's whatever, I have to say, and this is actually, I don't think I've ever mentioned this publicly before, when that record came out, I was kind of at a downturn in my life. Times were tough. I was working in a sheet metal factory. Not a great job, not a great situation. And there was a song on The Elder called I.
Oh, yeah.
I Believe in Me. And I used to, this horrible job, I would be thinking that in my brain, singing it to myself as I was doing these mundane, horrible tasks, that I can do better than this. I can be better than this. And that song is what resonated with me day in, day out at the Sheet Metal Factory. And, you know, I think it carried me over until I was able to leave there and kind of get my life back together. So I've always been thankful for that song alone.
Man, that's cool. That is a very inspirational, you know, self-motivational, you know, jam. Oh, I can put it on and be pumped, you know.
There are so many of their songs that are about believing in yourself and you can do it. And
hell yeah, that's like a central theme with Kiss. That and sex, those are the two main things.
I just don't think they get enough credit for that motivation that you can do anything. You've got Gene Simmons, an immigrant who chooses not to drink or do drugs, and he works hard, and look at the success he's got. And what, you know, that's a role model. I mean,
hell yeah.
It's important. And, you know, I remember Paul's last record. He's got that song Live to Win. I mean, right. You know, it's out there. Those guys do not get enough credit for the positive of it. And like I said, that song I kept me through a rough part of my life. It kept me going. It literally did. So,
that's,
you
know, awesome.
That's where music becomes more than just music. That's like life changing.
Right.
You know, without a song like that to hold on to, or something to hold on to, when you're at those downtrodden parts of your life, it's easy to keep, you know, once it's that you're down, it's easy to stay down. It's easier to do that than pick yourself back up.
Right.
And to have a song like that to hold on to be your mantra over and over and make you believe that you can do it. Because it's when you're down and people are telling you you belong there and that, you know, this is all you're ever going to be. It's easy to fall into that and believe that shit, and millions of people do. And that's bullshit, because there is not a one of us that can't make it happen.
Right.
And I always firmly believe that. So it's important. And I hope that anybody listening to this podcast, you know what, go grab your Elder record and go play that song. And when you're having a bad day, just believe in yourself and listen to that song, if nothing else.
Hell yeah, man. I'm Mr. Positive, bro, and I'm all about that. And you're right, man. And there's a bunch of other ones, especially Paul's songs. You know, he's a positive dude, and I respect that because I try to be that way myself. And you know, there's a bunch of them, but I think I is probably the top of the list on those, wouldn't you say?
And it's one that's easily missed by a lot of people, unfortunately.
Right.
But I think it's an important song, and you know, I hope that, like I said, hope talking about it now gets people to listen to it, because it really it's positive, it's uplifting, and it. Can, you know, it can change your life. Believing in yourself can change your life, and not believing in yourself can change your life. So it's important, and people just don't realize that.
Wise words from the author, Mr. Ken Barr. You gotta love that, man. I'm all about that. I'm on the same page as you, brother. And I want to thank you for coming on the show, man. It's been a really good time.
Oh, absolutely. I appreciate it. It's been great for me too. And I'm always glad to come back, so if you're ever needing a guest or an old roadie to spin some yarns and do whatever, I'd love to come back.
Hell yeah, we'll definitely make that happen, bro. It was a blast. And I want to just, you know, tell all the listeners, make sure they go check out Ken Barr. He's on quickest way to get it's Amazon, right?
Yeah, just look for my page. Go to books and search Ken Barr. You'll find my page. I've got a bunch of different books I've written over these past few years. YouTube, go to Ken Barr Films. I've got a film page there of the different shorts I've been working on. And just from there, you'll link to my Twitter and all that. TheRoadCrew.wordpress.com is my blog. And I'm on Facebook. You know, look me up, come say hello. I talk to a lot of people that come see the bands, and I'm always glad to answer questions.
Hell yeah.
I consider myself really privileged to have done what I did. So, if people have, you know, my entire career, if people have asked questions or sent emails or are, you know, always glad, because if it wasn't for people that cared about the bands I worked for, I wouldn't have done the things I did. So you can never repay that back. So I've always been appreciative of the people buying the tickets, buying the records, because that's how I made my living, off of them believing in the bands that, you know, I believed in.
Hell yeah, that's awesome, bro. So make sure you guys check him out there, Strange Ways listeners. Ken Barr, man, you got to check him out. You know, his book, we just scratched the surface on this podcast. He's got a million stories for you. So make sure you check it out. And I just want to say thanks for listening again. It's Jody Havnot from Strange Ways Podcast. And make sure you check us out on Facebook, iTunes, Stitcher, Podomatic, blah, blah, blah. Google us. You know the routine. And please leave us some a little review in iTunes. It helps a lot, apparently, and that's my little soapbox for now. Anyways, it's been another episode. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.
What are we waiting for?
I'm afraid I've given you all the time I can spare at the moment, my dear. You'll have to come back. Thank you, and goodbye.
You wanted the best, you got the best. And if you want the hottest show on Monco Radio, join us in the Kiss Room. The Kiss Room is a monthly radio broadcast celebrating the hottest band in the world.
Kiss!
It's your place for all things Kiss and some... For broadcast dates and all information, go to thekissroom.com. The Kiss Room broadcasts live and worldwide on Monco Radio, where music and minds meet.
Sometimes you don't sound like you're kidding. You know, there's a lot of people around.
Honey, I'm only kidding with you. We're having a party. I mean, I just came home. I haven't seen you in a long time, and I'm breaking your balls, and you're, right away, you're getting fucking fresh. I'm sorry. I don't mean to offend you.
I'm sorry, too. It's okay. No problem.
Okay, salute. Now go home and get your fucking
copy of Crazy Nights.
Motherfucking
History Science Theater. We bust balls because we care. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and all over the place.
Someone, somewhere, is needing to hear from you. Someone needing to know that you care. Care enough to give the gift of Podkist. Tell a friend about Podkist today. Download us on iTunes, friend us on Facebook, and rock your ass out. Podkist.
Podkist. Rock City.
What's up, everybody? Joe here from Podkist Rock City. Join me each and every week as I give you my opinion on all the KISS topics and news of the week. I talk about every era of KISS with a number of guest hosts from all your favorite KISS podcasts. Check the show out on iTunes, Podomatic, Stitcher, and YouTube. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Podkist Rock City, your 20-minute KISS fix.
Hi, KISS fans. This is J.R. Smalling, and I'm pleased to announce the release of our new book, Out on the Streets, written by me and the other members of the original KISS crew. This book chronicles the glory days of the hottest band in the land from 1974 to 1976. You'll hear the real tales of what it was like to be on the road with KISS during those early years. For more information or to purchase, visit our website at www.theoriginalkisscrew.com. That's crew with a K. You wanted the book and you got it! And we hope that you enjoy it.
I love you. Bye.